morning, everybody. Welcome to Center Finance. Time is 3 minutes after 9 a.m. Wednesday, March 31st, 2010. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Huggins, Senator Thomas, and Senator Egan, and myself, Senator Stedman. We have seven bills on the agenda, of which we won't complete this morning in an hour and a half, and we will flow over then tomorrow. We have morning and afternoon sessions tomorrow, so we're going to work on today's agenda today and tomorrow and until it's complete. Senate Bill 305, which is the separation of oil and gas production tax, will be rolled down the calendar, probably will be the second bill up today. We're still waiting on a document on that. Senate Bill 33, post-secondary scholarship, will be the first one up today. Senate Bill 139, incentives for certain medical providers. Senate Bill 174, professional student exchange loan forgiveness. Senate Bill 235, charter alternative school funding. Senate Bill 236, tax credits for educational contributions. And Senate Bill 224, post-secondary scholarships. The committee needs to adjourn at 10:30 today, which is a half hour early. So many of these bills, like I had mentioned earlier, we won't get to, and we'll start tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. So we'll go ahead and start today's labor with Senate Bill 33 by Senator Ellis regarding post-secondary scholarships. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to adopt a committee substitute, have the sponsor introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. Senator Hoffman may have a motion to adopt committee substitute version W.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt a CS for Senate Bill 33, Finance/W as our working document.
And I'll object for discussion. And we have staff support from Senator Ellis. But Senator Ellis, would you like to start this process, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for having the bill before you today. For the record, I'm Johnny Ellis, representing the Senate District L, downtown and midtown Anchorage. I originally introduced Senate Bill 33, and I'm joined by Mr. Max Hensley and Mr. Matt Moser, who've helped me with this project. Mr. Chairman, I originally introduced Senate Bill 33 in 2006 as the Alaska Achievers Incentive Program. Worked with student leaders from across the state, gained sponsorship from Senators Thomas, Pasquin, Stevens, and McGuire. Had the project endorsed by the Taylor Foundation. Many of you have met with them, the Juneau Assembly and the Fairbanks Assembly. And the original bill created a hybrid need and merit-based scholarship program for the state of Alaska that would have provided at least $1,000 per year to high-achieving students with financial need. The governor's introduction of the GPS legislation this past summer elevated the issue. It was very exciting that the issue got more attention, and I'm very pleased to see the slate of policy options that we'll be discussing today with this bill and other bills. Over the past 8 months, I've been engaged in many conversations with my colleagues, financial aid experts, University of Alaska folks, students and parents, and although I'm a strong supporter of many of the concepts expressed by the governor in his bill, I'm also very concerned about the future implementation of the bill, as well as the opportunity to get something passed this year. I think that's of concern for all of us here at the end of the 90-day session. Senate Bill 33 addresses those concerns in ways that reflect the many conversations I've had. And I call this new version of Senate Bill 33 the Alaska Advantage Grant and Loan Forgiveness Program. But I really don't care what it's called. If it turns out to be the Alaska Student Achievement Program, from the Education Committee, the ASAP, or the governor, the GPS, the name doesn't really matter at all. Pride of authorship is not a concern. The Alaska Advantage Grant and Loan Forgiveness Program adds a loan forgiveness component to the existing Alaska Advantage Grant Program. So we're building on the existing framework. Students who were eligible for the Alaska Advantage Grants can receive funds to forgive loans made through ACPE for up to 4 years after graduation if they attend Alaska institutions and remain with their education here in the state of Alaska. In contrast, the GPS is fully a scholarship-based approach, which rewards students on potential rather than performance. Nothing really wrong with that, but this is a slightly different approach to the issue. This bill maintains the emphasis on priority career tracks. That was a concern of Senator Huggins that he expressed publicly and I listened to carefully. The bill increased grant amounts are included for students in preparation for hard-to-fill jobs. Currently, those in the program are allied health, community service, teaching, and natural resource extraction and support. And there's an article in your packets about the workforce shortage for a future pipeline. For loan forgiveness, graduates must be employed in those fields for increased rewards. In contrast, GPS does not have any emphasis on developing Alaska's workforce. This also adds a merit-based priority. Increased grant amounts in this bill for students who are performing at a high level in college. For loan forgiveness, an increased award depends on final GPA. The bill also updates the award amounts to reflect today's cost of higher education. Minimum annual award of $1,000, maximum annual award of $5,000, total lifetime cap, whether received in grants or loan forgiveness, of $20,000 per student. So there's a cost containment element. The structure allows the legislature through appropriations process to manage the cost, and I know that's been a concern of folks discussing the GPS. In contrast to GPS, which is set up as an entitlement in which program derives cost. Other GPS concerns addressed by the Alaska Advantage grant and loan forgiveness would be non-traditional students. Big concern expressed in the Senate Education Committee. Continuing education, workers changing careers, older first-time students are all ineligible for GPS but qualify for this bill. Many rural students are disqualified for the GPS by the curriculum requirements that are not available in 20% of Alaska's high schools. We hope so in the future, but at the moment, many folks would have a hard time. Those requirements also create an unfunded mandate of uncertain cost on local school districts and our EAAs. So, Mr. Chairman, we do have options if no bill passes, so I'm projecting forward if we're not able to pass a bill here in the closing weeks of the session. We do have some options, and I would suggest funding the existing Alaska Advantage grant program, currently receiving no GF. We could fund that. $5 million is an appealing figure to me. We could fund existing UA Scholars Program, currently receiving no GF at $5 million. So $10 million for a one-year appropriation compared to $36 to $40 million of recurring costs in the GPS program, the $10 million I think would have some appeal for the budget writers this year. I would also recommend, if we aren't able to pass a bill, to set up a task force to continue work on the transformative scholarship concepts in the governor's scholarship program. That was more than I intended to say, Mr. Chair, but my staffer, Max Hensley, has a brief comment and can walk us quickly through the sections of the bill.
That was quite an opening statement on the bill.
Well, you know, this may be my only opportunity, so I'm trying to get it all in.
So we'll go to your trusty staff. If you could walk us through the CS changes, please, so we can look at the adoption.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Ellis. My name is Max Hensley, staff to Senator Ellis. I hope everyone has in front of them the W version of Senate Bill 33. And I just briefly, before I walk through the bill, I want to dispel a couple of things. This is not the old loan forgiveness program that many people may remember. There's a couple of significant differences. First, it only includes students who attend college in the state of Alaska. That was a policy call made by the governor and his GPS maintained in the Senate Education Committee. We felt it was important to ensure that these state funds go to build up Alaska's economy and Alaska's system of higher education. And second, it has a more limited cost. Rather than 50% of the total loan amount, it's limited to a particular dollar figure per year with a lifetime cap, as Senator Ellis mentioned. Third, it's more easily tracked because it's limited to only loans made through the state's loan programs. It's an internal program that can be easily monitored. And those were all problems that were expressed themselves in the old loan forgiveness that were part of the reason that it went away. Section 1 of the bill, to walk through very quickly, amends the purpose of the Alaska Advantage Grant Program to include loan forgiveness. You'll see that there. Sections 2, 3, and 9 are conforming amendments to add loan forgiveness to the title of that chapter of statute. Section 4, which starts at page 2, line 7, defines the size of the program. This is what Senator Ellis was speaking of when In terms of legislative control over the appropriations, the draft conceptualizes a $10 million amount, but the will of the committee can decide that that size. Section 5 extends the current priorities in the grant program for career tracks and adds a merit-based priority in a similar fashion to the career priority. First priority, two levels, first for students with a GPA over 3.0, and then a higher priority for students with a GPA over 3.5. Section 6, towards the bottom of page 2, outlines the qualifications for the new loan forgiveness. Students must be an Alaska resident, have graduated in the previous 4 years from an Alaska institution of higher education, and in good standing on their loan repayment on their own. Sections 7 and 8, towards the bottom of page 3, outline the level of awards per student, a minimum of $1,000, a maximum of $5,000 per year. Within those levels, the amount of award would depend on whether the student is a full-time or part-time student, and then the various priorities for careers and merit-based increased award amounts. And then Section 8 is the lifetime cap of $20,000 per student. Section 9, as I said, changes the title of the chapter. If the committee has any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them. Thank you.
Senator Thomas, questions on the CS?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see that the allocation has been made to eligible students. How is that allocation made between loan forgiveness and grants?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, that's left up to the Commission on Postsecondary Education to decide in regulation. The current program places the highest priority on the students with the most need, and so I would imagine that, you know, they would work. They would have to work up some regulations on how to balance forgiveness versus grants, but that's how they do it currently.
Okay, thank you, and I am supportive of the changes in the bill. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Any other questions on the CS? I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption of the CS. Any further objection to the adoption of the CS? Seeing none, we have adopted version W. Senator Ellis.
That concluded my presentation. That was plenty.
Do we have any further questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the fiscal note, since we're the Finance Committee, I'm a little confused here. In the fiscal note, it looks like it's $25,000, but as you look down to the analysis, it says the amount of $25 million. I was wondering, am I reading it wrong?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the fiscal note refers to the previous version of the bill. The $25,000 was for the administration of the fund that was thought of in the old version. We do not have a fiscal note for this particular CS at this time.
We'll have a brief adios. There's a fiscal note from the Department of Revenue for $25,000 in general funds. That's to cover the investment management fee. And then there's one fiscal note from the Department of Education and Early Development for $125,000 in general funds designated or designed for the implementation. But these are older fiscal notes that need to be updated. Do we have any other questions? Do we have anybody call in? No one signed up? Any final questions? Senator Ellis, any final comments?
No, just thank you again, Mr. Chairman, for having this before us. I just wanted to get this out on the table as options that we could have for moving forward. I hope we don't lose a year on this subject, and we do have options to move forward.
Okay. We're going to go ahead and set this bill aside for further review, and we'll have a brief at ease. go ahead and bring the Senate Finance Committee back to order. We're now going to bring up Senate Bill 305, better known as the Oil and Gas Decoupling Bill. So we have a new CS for Senate Bill 305, a new sectional analysis from Mr. Don Bullock, who works at Ledge Legal, a new Finance Committee zero fiscal note, and one small technical amendment to the new CS. The intent today is to adopt the new CS, ask Legislative Legal and our legislative consultants to walk through the changes since the last time the committee heard the bill, and we'll take up amendment number one. And unless there are other concerns, we'll look to the will of the committee. We've already taken public testimony on this bill previously. Senator Hoffman, may I have a motion to adopt a new committee substitute LS 1577 version T dated 3/30/2010.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt CS for Senate Bill 305 / T as a working document.
And I'll object for explanations and invite Mr. Don Bullock, seeing in the crowd, and Roger Marks to the table to walk us through the CS, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Donald Bullock. I'm one of your attorneys in Legislative Legal Services, and I've been assigned to work on SB 305 for the committee. Before I get to the bill, I just want to remind you of a few fundamentals that are involved in this, that the production tax value of oil and gas is what the tax is applied to. And starting with PPT and then ACES, the production tax value is basically the gross value at the point of production minus allowable lease expenditures under 43.55.165, adjusted under 4355.170. Because the lease expenditures are related to the production tax value, whenever you separate oil from gas for tax purposes, you have to allocate lease expenditures, and that's addressed in this bill. Currently, the allocation is already required because of special provisions that relate to oil and gas produced in Cook Inlet, as well as gas produced outside of Cook Inlet and used in the state. The tax is basically 25 plus. There's a 25% rate that's applied to the production tax value of all oil and gas, and then the plus is a progressive tax that increases in rate as the production tax value rises above $30. The main difference between the bill I'll explain here in a minute, version T, which the committee has before you, and the previous version, is that the new version provides for a progressive tax on gas, whereas the previous version just had a progressive tax applied to oil. The title's been amended to reflect the contents of version T and is narrow to address the progressive rates. Are there any questions just on the general application of the tax? Okay. The first section of version T amends 296850B. This section did not appear previously in version P, which was the earlier version that the committee had. And this just says is that money that's generated by the progressive taxes in G, which is applicable to oil, and new subsection P, which is applicable to gas, are available for appropriation to the Community Revenue Sharing Fund. This section was not in the previous version because there continued to be a progressive tax in G, which was already available. And the Community Revenue Sharing Fund was established for the purpose of making community revenue sharing payments to municipalities, reserves, and communities for public purposes. That was not a dedicated fund. It merely identified money from that part of the tax as available for appropriation. Section 2 of the bill amends 4355011E. 4355011E is the main tax provision, and it makes separate references to the monthly progressive taxes on oil and gas. The progressive tax on oil produced gas produced in Cook Inlet and gas produced outside of Cook Inlet and used in the state are used to determine the rate, which is the average amount of those values, compared to $30. And then to the extent that that value is above $30, the rate is increased. Section 3 amends 4355011G to have the tax rate determined using the production tax values of oil, the production tax values on a BTU equivalent basis of gas produced in Cook Inlet and gas produced elsewhere and used in the state. Gas in Cook Inlet and gas produced outside of Cook Inlet and used in the state are subject to caps on the tax, so they're tax-favored production. Section 4 adds the progressivity tax for gas. It provides, and the progressive tax is based on the average value of the gas that's not included earlier in G. And it provides that once that rate's determined, it's applied to the production tax value of a BTU equivalent of gas. There was no counterpart to this section in the earlier version, as version T introduces a progressive tax on gas. In both the progressive taxes and G and P, there's no change in the range of which that tax rate's determined. It's still the same range, and the tax rates are still the same. There's no change in those aspects. Every time there's a change in the tax scheme, there has to be a corresponding change in the installment payments. The tax is paid monthly, and there's a makeup payment at the end of the year. So basically, the monthly payment should reflect 1/12 of the total liability for the tax for the year. Section 5 amends AS 4355020A, which provides for the determination of the installment payments. This takes into consideration the new progressive tax on gas in this version, as well as the changes in the progressive tax for oil that includes gas produced in Cook Inlet and gas produced outside of Cook Inlet and used in the state. Section 6 amends AS 4355020D relating to settlements with the royalty owners. There was no similar provision in the previous version because a progressive tax was not a factor in determining the settlement with the royalty owner under the previous bill version. Again, like I said at the opening, that the production tax value is what the tax rates are applied to. AS 4355160 relates to the determination of what that production tax value is. Section 7 of version T amends 160A relating to the determination of the production tax value of oil and gas by providing the means for determining the production tax value of oil and the production tax value of gas separately. There's also some reordering of sections in this, but the reordering did not make a substantive change. Section 7 in the prior version, in draft version P, also amended this section, but it amended the subsection by removing references to gas because there was only a progressive rate on oil in the earlier version. This version provides for determination of the value with reference to both oil and gas. Section 8 relates to what I offered earlier about the allocation of lease expenditures between oil and gas. Currently, the Department of Revenue has the authority to make the allocation under AS 4355165H. Section 8 in version T amends that section by requiring that the Department of Revenue consider allocating lease expenditures in proportion to the BTU equivalent barrels of oil produced and gas produced from each lease or property. This doesn't say they have to use it. The purpose here is to provide a reasonable allocation of expenditures between oil and gas. As you know, PPT and ACE has introduced a new concept in our production tax. Prior to PPT and ACE's tax was on the gross value at the point of production, which is now the starting point for determining the production tax value. And since lease expenditures are applied to that gross value at the point of production to determine the production tax value. When you're determining those values separately for oil and gas, you have to allocate the leases separately for oil and gas. Section 9 is similar to the provision in Section 8, but it amends AS 4355-170D, or it adds a new section. Section 170 has to do with adjustments to lease expenditures, and this section says the Department of Revenue shall determine how to allocate the adjustments to the lease expenditures in relation to oil and gas, and then again ask them to consider allocating the adjustments based on the BTU equivalent. Section 10 has, let me talk about Section 11 first. Section 11 is a section that makes the progressive tax provisions of the bill, which are the progressive taxes on oil and gas, retroactive to January 1st, 2010. There was no similar provision in the earlier bill because it had a prospective effective date. Because of the retroactive effect, and because installment payments will have been required to be made after December 31st and before the effective date of this act, Section 10 just requires that if, should there be an installment payment, and actually none is expected, that underpayment would be made up at the first installment payment due after the effective date of the act. Finally, Section 12 makes the act take effect immediately. That's an immediate effective date. There are some sections that were in the previous version that don't have corresponding provisions in the current bill. Section 3 in draft version P amended 4355-011J by adding a reference to the taxes in E, but since E, 4355-011E provides a tax as well as a progressive tax on both oil and gas, there's no reason to differentiate between the different subparts of subsection E. Same thing was in Section 4 of the previous version. Section 8 in the previous version removed a reference to the gas for the purposes of determining the progressive tax rate. Since this version has a progressive rate for gas as well as oil, it's not necessary in this version. And Section 11 made the act applicable after the effective date of the act. The version T provides for a retroactive application of the changes back to January 1st, 2010. And that's version T. The amendment that will be offered, there's a correction that needs to be.
We'll wait for that.
Okay.
Do we have any additional questions on adoption of version T? Senator Thomas on version T.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 4, is that specific to producers in that have production of gas and oil both in Prudhoe Bay or the North Slope as well as Cook Inlet? Is that what that one is tended to?
Yes. The way the tax caps works is they determine their tax as the same as if it was produced anywhere. But the caps apply after the tax is determined, so it says they can't be more than the historical tax.
Okay. All right. That's good. Thank you.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, in Section 8, my question is the allocating of the leased expenditures between oil and gas, the effective date of that, since we're essentially not selling gas at this point in time with the North Slope.
I'm sorry, Senator, could you read
the question, please?
Yes, Section 8.
Page 11.
Which is the allocation of lease expenditures between oil and gas. My question is there a separate effective date for that allocation to begin?
No, the department's actually required to do it now. What this does is it introduces a new provision that when they're making that determination after this section becomes effective is that they should consider allocating on a BTU equivalent basis. They could do that now. This just expresses a preference by the legislature that this should be strongly considered when adopting the regulations. I believe Mr. Marks may have a comment.
Mr. Marks? Roger Marks with Glogson Associates, under contract with Legislative Budget and Audit. In addition, you know, the department had the authority to adopt regulations for a cost allocation method to implement the tax as it currently works. There is, under the current law, there's still a need to allocate costs, and the department had the authority, and the method they did adopt is what is the method that we've said here that they should consider. That's what they actually adopted when they had the authority to choose their own method.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have any other questions, Senator Egan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bullock, on Section 5, page 6, line 21, why the date 2022? I guess, I don't know why it sunsets.
Hold on, let me pull up the law here.
Page 6, line 21.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
That, through the chair, the special tax breaks that are applicable to Cook Inlet Oil, Cook Inlet Gas, and also to gas produced outside of Cook Inlet and used in the state are applicable before the year 2022. And this date on page 6, line 21, is inserted to reflect that change that will in the future when those tax benefits go away.
So it goes away in 2022?
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions on version T? I'll go ahead and remove my objection to adoption of version T. Any further objection to adoption of version T? Seeing none, we have adopted version T. We have amendment number one. Senator Hoffman?
Mr. Chairman, I move the amendment number one.
I'll object for discussion. Mr. Bullock?
Mr. Chairman, amendment number one corrects an oversight I made in drafting the bill, and it removes extraneous language that doesn't make sense in the context of the new version of the bill.
Okay. Do we have any questions on adoption of amendment number one? Okay, I'll remove my objection to adoption of amendment number one. Any further objection to amendment number one? Seeing none, amendment number one is adopted. We're back to the main bill adopted and amended version T. Do we have any questions, final questions from the committee? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at the bill and the new portion, especially the progressivity that's there, and there's a number of other, obviously, a number of other sections that are dealing with other issues, but a lot of distinction is between the Cook Inlet gas and the gas that's produced above the 68th parallel. I was wondering, is this also applicable to all other gas fields, like the Nenana gas field that may be developed in other gas fields that are throughout the state that are outside of Cook Inlet?
Through the chair, the law generally applies to all gas and oil that's produced in the state. The special provisions are narrowly focused on gas and oil produced in Cook Inlet and gas produced outside of Cook Inlet that are used in the state. So the production from those particular areas and the uses is addressed by the bill. And there's no other specific provisions that are similar to other areas.
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. Those of us that live above the 68th parallel, we feel like the stepchild out there. Oh. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, sometimes the folks in Southeast feel like stepchildren on occasions, too.
With all due respect, Mr. Chairman, I think they call their redheaded stepchild.
Okay. We'll go to and ask Mr. Marks to walk us through the fiscal note, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it would be useful in describing the fiscal note. I think it would be useful to sort of discuss some of the technical changes that Mr. Bullock described in a more conversational sense, so people understand sort of how this is put together and what it means. The way what we've set up here is we've put progressivity on gas, but what we've done is establish two progressivity buckets, for lack of a better word. The first progressivity bucket is sort of represents the activity we have now in the state, a producer who has oil and a producer who has inlet gas or other gas they're producing that's sold in the state. That represents all the activity that's going on in the state right now. And that kind of activity would be in one bucket for calculating progressivity. The other bucket would be export gas. If you have, we have a major gas sale and gas leaves the state, that gas would be put in a separate bucket for progressivity. And the reason we set that up and why this affects the fiscal note is we discussed previously the issue of if we were to calculate, you know, right now progressivity is calculated combined oil and gas activity. And if we were to separate progressivity between oil and gas and calculate them distinctly, for those producers who are producing like North Slope oil and Cook Inlet gas or North Slope oil and North Slope gas mounts that are like sold to Alyeska, for those producers, if progressivity was calculated distinctly, their progressivity on oil would go up if the gas were removed from that calculation, and they would see a tax increase. And it was not the intent of this bill to increase taxes on current activity, so there was a concern about keeping the bill revenue neutral. Now, in the previous version of the bill, version P, in Section 5, we had discussed dealing with that with having a credit where any producer that saw a tax increase as a result of the bill, they would simply get a credit for the difference between the taxes as they were calculated after the bill passed minus what they were how they were calculated after the difference between before the bill passed and after the bill passed. And in thinking about that, we became aware that could be administratively cumbersome for both the taxpayers and the administration to every single month figure out two different sets of taxes for this credit. So came up with a different method for getting the same result, and that was to create these two buckets for progressivity. One bucket, again, would be oil, Cook Inlet gas, and other gas that's sold in state. That would be all that activity would go into one bucket for calculating progressivity, and the second bucket again would be export gas. And as a result of that, current producers there would be as a result of that, number one, no current activity would see a tax increase, so the bill is kept revenue neutral, hence a zero fiscal note. And the second result of that would be that export gas, if and when we have a major gas sale, that gas would not dilute the oil progressivity factor. So we would reinforce the state's financial picture by not having the oil taxes crater, as it will, under certain price scenarios if with a major gas sale. So that's so the bottom line is, you know, zero fiscal note. And the reason why is because we've set up the progressivity with that structure of the two different buckets.
Simplify the process so the industry and the doesn't have to do two sets of calculations to come to the same conclusion.
Correct.
Do we have any other questions on the fiscal note? Seeing none, do we have any final questions on the bill? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very simple question. Progressivity in this bill on gas is the same as it was originally before decoupling. Is that correct?
Correct, but go ahead.
Senator Huggins, through the chair, that's exact. The progressivity calculation for gas would be the exact same as it is now. It's the production tax value on a barrel of oil equivalent minus $30 times the 0.4%.
Thank you very much.
Any final questions? Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out CS for Senate Bill 305/T with individual recommendations and the new Finance Committee fiscal note.
As amended.
As amended.
Okay. We have a motion to move version T from committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Do we have objection? Seeing no objection, we'll move the bill from committee to the next committee of referral. We'll go on now and pick up Senate Bill 139 by Senator Olson regarding incentives for certain medical providers. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to adopt a committee substitute, have the sponsor introduce the bill and take public testimony and set the bill aside for further review. Senator Hoffman, may I have a motion to adopt committee substitute version N?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt CS for Senate Bill 139/D as N as our working document.
And I'll object for explanation, and we have Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee, for hearing this very important bill. What Senate Bill 139 does is it establishes a loan repayment program and employment incentives for the a number of healthcare professionals employed throughout the state, and addresses an immediate need that we have here that's growing worse by the day, actually. And one of the ways that it distinguishes itself from other scholarship bills that are out there is that we have immediate results for filling vacancies, which means we're not waiting for students to come through the pipeline before they can start their practice. It also targets experienced providers that are out there who are ready to go to work, many of which have already been in the workplace and gone through their residency if it's been required, and certainly have gone through school. These funds are going to be after the work has been performed and payments will be stopped if for some reason the practitioner leaves the state or leaves the area that he's been designated. And since this is not a loan, there are loans that are held by the state. There are no defaults that we've got to worry about, since that's one of the concerns that's been brought up. And although there's a preference for Alaskans, this provides a wider pool to go ahead and draw from, where schools anywhere in the or graduates from anywhere in the nation can come to Alaska to take advantage of this incentive or loan repayment program. And in general, it targets a more comprehensive list of healthcare providers that throughout the state. Most concerning has to do with the top three. And just to put it into perspective, one of the reasons we are dealing with physicians, and physicians in particular, is because, let's just face it, if any one of us drops here of a heart attack or we have a problem, you know, with all due respect, the best person to take care of you is going to be a physician. Pharmacists have their place, dentists have their place, dental hygienists have their place, nurse practitioners have their place. But when I wake up, the best chances of waking up in most cases, if somebody's pumping on your chest, is to have an MD or a DO there calling out the orders. With that, Mr. Chairman, with that in mind, I will have my Chief of Staff, Denise Liccioli, go ahead and present the specifics of the bill. But don't forget, when somebody's pumping on your chest, especially if it's your relative, you want a physician there calling out the orders.
What we need to do is walk through the changes in the CS and adopt the CS, and then we'll come back to the bill. If you can take us through the changes in the CS, please.
For the record, my name is Denise Liccioli. I'm staff to Senator Olson, and I'd be happy to walk you through the changes that are in this version of the bill. There are actually two areas that were changed. The first is on page 1, line 8, and the words "by the state" were added to that line, and also on page 2, line 9 and 10, it says "by the state." We added that language to limit the loan repayments to loans that are held by the state. We did this in deference to some concerns or ideas that had been expressed to us regarding why we would be interested in repaying loans that were held by other states or the federal government or even a banking institution. And after giving it some thought and doing some research, we determined that it really didn't matter, that if we were providing a direct incentive, the participant could take that money and pay back their loans or use it in whichever way they wanted. And so for the sake of administrative efficiency, we made this change to limit the loan repayment portion to only those loans held by the state of Alaska. The second change that was made was by adding a new section. And that section is on page 5, beginning on line 9 of your CS. And in that section, we provided better clarification to the department for what the intention was with this legislation, to limit the number of participants to 90 per year, regardless of whether the participant was a new participant or a continuing participant, and to also provide guidance that we wanted to ensure that at least 3 of each practitioner type was reserved for filling in a very hard-to-fill location, because we are trying with this bill to address healthcare shortages in various areas throughout the state, and we didn't want to have a situation, particularly with limiting it to 90, where you would get a lot of applications for an area of the state, one particular area of the state, and then not have any slots left to fill in the areas that might really need it. So by adding this section, we define those limits a little better for the department to be able to issue regulations. And those are the two changes to the bill, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
So. Do we have any questions on the adoption of CS? Senator Thomas on the CS.
Well, I don't know if specific to the CS, but just the bill maybe in general regarding the areas that require some specific hours of supervision before they can be licensed. And I was just curious if this would apply to those folks prior to them being licensed.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, this bill targets only people who are licensed or become licensed in the state to practice in whichever slot they're applying for.
Okay. All right. We have any further questions on the adoption of the CS? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and adopt CS version N as our working document. Senator Olson, would you like to present the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've talked about some aspects of the bill already, especially the changes that have been there. The most significant one has to do with the one that you just pointed out, with the limited number of participants that can be there. But I think on the whole, this bill addresses in a more comprehensive manner some of the issues that are coming up in front of us, and especially as we have an elderly population that are more dependent on some type of health care. I think it's very important that we address it now and that we continue on to make sure that when we are in need of that, if we have the best chance of living a quality, a lifestyle that has some type of qualitative element to it. With that, Ms. Licciole will present the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Excuse me. Alaska is facing a serious shortage of healthcare practitioners, especially in the rural areas of the state, and it is projected to worsen significantly in the next few decades. Senate Bill 139 is intended to address this issue by establishing a program to immediately begin filling the vacant healthcare practitioners' positions throughout the state. This legislation would establish a direct incentive in loan repayment for loans held by the state of Alaska in the Department of Health and Social Services. The program is designed to be competitive with other states and attract healthcare practitioners to Alaska, and also, I might add, to retain them once they have been come to our state. Senate Bill 139 will provide those direct incentives and loan repayments for 10 specific healthcare occupations that are categorized by tier. Tier 1 occupations, there are 3 of them, and Senator Olson mentioned those previously, those being a physician, a dentist, or a pharmacist. And then Tier 2 slots are dental hygienists, nurse practitioners, nurses, physical therapists, physician assistants, psychologists, and licensed clinical social workers. The slots are also categorized by whether they would be filled in a regular slot within a regular location within the state or in a very hard to fill location within the state. And those sites would be determined by the Department of Health and Social Services. And I've been told by them that they currently that they would not be exactly the same as the federal designations as such, but they do have the data to be able to fairly quickly modify those locations and come up with a list as it pertains to this bill. The amount of the incentive for each slot will vary depending on whether they're in Tier 1 or Tier 2 and whether they're filled in a regular or a very hard-to-fill site. And the bill will provide direct incentives and loan repayments for 9 slots for each of those occupations that are listed. And the fiscal note is assuming that at least, well, as the bill would require at least 3 of the 9 to be in very hard-to-fill locations. The fiscal note that's attached to this allows for funding of 6 positions in very hard-to-fill locations just because of the uncertainty of not knowing where applicants might apply for within the state. We do not expect all 9 to be in very hard-to-fill, although we'd be thrilled if they were. Priority will be given to sites that treat patients who are uninsured or who have medical assistance or Medicare coverage. And the maximum slots, as I stated before, is 90 in any given year, whether they're a new participant or a continuing participant. I would also like to state that we've been asked about whether we wanted to do all 90 in 1 year or if we wanted to divide them up. And we intentionally left it to be 90 per year to give more flexibility, not knowing how the applicants might come in for which slots or which areas and which tier. So by allowing for 90, we feel that there probably will not be 90 the first year that apply, and that that will take care of itself through that. But by allowing for all 90 in the first year, we give the department flexibility. Should those that are the more expensive slots be the ones that are applied for first, they would have the ability to do that and then to adjust in later years what slots they had available. The eligible individuals are provided their incentive or loan repayment in quarterly installments, and they only get a payment after they have been working the previous 3 months, and they do have to sign a contract for up to 3 years, stating that they would stay for that period of time. The program does allow for a possible extension for an additional 3 years, but caps it at a maximum of 6 for any individual. And I would add that if an individual does apply for that second 3-year period, they would have to go through an application just as new applicants would have to. So there would be no guarantee that they would get it for that second 3-year slot. But we wanted to allow that possibility in case we didn't have enough applications. I would also add that payments would stop immediately if for some reason the practitioner leaves their position. So. The employer of the participant would also share in the cost of the amount provided. The bill allows for up to a 50% match depending on each employer's ability to pay. The Department of Health and Social Services would have to work with each of the individual employers and make that determination. The fiscal note assumes a 25% net match to allow for some employers perhaps having zero match and other employers having as much as 50%. So the fiscal note reflects that at 25% for the grantee payments. So in summary, Senate Bill 139 is an effective way to address the shortage of healthcare practitioners quickly and targets experienced practitioners who are ready to work. Although preference can be given to Alaskans, practitioners can be from anywhere in the nation, which means that that does greatly increase the pool of qualified applicants who would be potentially eligible. The program established by this bill will be an effective complement and not a replacement for other programs such as WAMI and other scholarship type programs that might exist to fill the gap while students are getting their education and the training that they need to become a practitioner. And Senate Bill 139 will help us to save and improve the lives of our constituents by allowing us to provide for those who cannot wait until tomorrow to get the health care that they need today. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm available for questions.
Do members have any initial questions? Senator Thomas.
Basically, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the same question I see in the bill, and it appears that everybody that is eligible is a profession that requires licensing. And on page 5, it does make it clear that for the direct incentive payment, it says be licensed. But my question is just the narrow one, that if a person can receive loan repayments if they are not licensed yet, but are still in the process of completing the 1,500 or 3,000 hours that may be required, like in the case of a social worker or a psychologist, that type of.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, also on page 5, line 21, they have to be licensed or become licensed within 90 days after their first day of employment. So it does allow for someone who might be licensed, for example, in another state, or they just came out of school and are beginning to get their license. It does give them that short time frame for them to do what's necessary in order to become licensed.
Okay. That's what I was looking for. Thank you.
Any other questions on the bill? Initial questions? Okay, we have two fiscal notes in your packet. One zero fiscal note from the Department of Education and Early Development. One fiscal note from the Department of Health and Social Services for $2,882,300 in general funds to cover the estimated cost of incentive payments and to hire one additional full-time staff person to administer the program. The committee will request updated fiscal notes to reflect the current adopted CS. We'll go now to
Mr. Chairman.
Yes?
If I could add, I believe that the two fiscal notes you have are updated to the CS.
Okay. Well, we could, yeah, we'll check that and make sure. We're going to go to the public hearing portion. We have several people signed up to testify. We need to keep the testimony to 2 minutes, and I need you to start, if you could please, identifying yourself and who you represent, and then speak to the bill. We'll start in Ketchikan with Lynette Lundberg, please.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Lynetta Lundberg. I'm the Director of Human Resources and Physician Recruitment at Ketchikan General Hospital. I am pleased to be a constituent in the district you represent, Mr. Chairman, and the opportunity to go on record in support of Senate Bill 139 that would establish a healthcare professions loan repayment and incentive program. We have experienced and continue to experience long-standing vacancies and recruitment for physicians, pharmacists, physicians, physical therapists, registered nurses, and clinical social workers. All of these positions have been on our community recruiting program most wanted list, some since the beginning of our program 5 years ago. Many conversations with persons of interest are highly interested in living, working, and playing in Alaska, but often comment on the large loan debt they bear or their earning power outside of Alaska. As an organization, we have included loan repayment and forgiveness with offers. However, in more cases than not, the professional declines our offer for a better financial package that includes a better loan repayment program and or incentive component. A state loan repayment and incentive program would enhance, incentivize, and draw a larger pool of healthcare professionals to Alaska. Appropriated funds to support a healthcare professions loan repayment and incentive program is an investment in the future of providing healthcare to Alaskans. The value and return on this investment could be realized many times over. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony today. We'll now go to Wasilla. Jerry Gronin. Jerry and Wasilla.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm in Anchorage, but good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jerry Grauer. I am a lifelong Alaskan and a constituent from the Kinnick area of Wasilla. I attend UAA. I'm a graduate student in my final semester of the Master's of Social Work program. I've worked in a variety of environments and roles as an employee and student in the health and human services field. After I graduate in May, I will have a 3-month deferment on my student loan payments. Between my bachelor's and master's degree, I will have accumulated well over $70,000 in student loans. I've never borrowed more than I needed and always accepted work to keep up with my financial obligations. I will have to commit a minimum of 2 years in the field before I can obtain my license for clinical social work. High burnout rates in the healthcare field are more than enough of a reason to offer reimbursements and incentives to workers. This incentive will help motivate workers to stay in their positions in Alaska and provide services to all Alaskans in need. Without a reimbursement program, I will give serious consideration to moving out of state in order to have a better future and ensure that I stay in the field of social work. From my experience, the average clinical social worker earns around $40,000 a year, much lower than other professionals named in the proposed legislation. This pay may sound okay, but when you consider the amount of debt a worker obtains from gaining a graduate degree, there is an obvious difficulty in making ends meet. Our state must remain competitive with other states to keep workers in Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for holding this important hearing, and I urge you to support Senate Bill 139.
Okay, thank you for your testimony today. Jim Lynch, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Lynch. I'm in Fairbanks. I'm the Chief Finance Officer for Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. I also happen to serve as the Chairman for the Governor's Workforce Investment Board, and I'm currently a member of a steering committee for a statewide health industry coalition that is developing a statewide workforce development strategic plan, which we expect to complete in the summer of 2010 and have before you before the next legislative session. I'm speaking today in support of SB 139. I will keep my comments to the broad high level. It was just referenced about the need to be competitive. I want to make sure the committee is aware, as I'm sure you are, with the impending retirement wave of the baby boomer generation. In the healthcare industry, this is going to have a dual impact, with not only will we be losing skilled workers to retirement, but as we all age as a population, we'll also be dramatically increasing the demand for healthcare services. This problem exists nationally and to a certain extent globally. So I believe in the next 20 years we're going to see a competition for these skilled licensed positions that we have not seen before in our lifetime. It's my understanding, Senators, that Alaska is only one of a few, I believe five states, that do not have a state-sponsored program of this type. This means when we as a rural state are competing for these professionals, we will be at a distinct disadvantage. We use this tool in the private sector in a similar manner. It is a very effective tool, and most specifically, it's a very cost-effective tool. You do get a direct impact from the funds that we are requesting that you invest here through this bill. With that, I'll limit my testimony and leave time for others. But let me please say that I'm available at any point should any of you have any questions or if I can be of any assistance. I want to thank Senator Olson and his staff for their work on this. I think it's a very important issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Jim Lynch?
That was him.
Excuse me.
Yes, sir.
Excuse me, Jim. I didn't get your mark correctly. Jim Jordan. Is he online?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. This is Jim Jordan. For the record, I am the Executive Director of the Alaska State Medical Association, which is an association that represents physicians statewide and is primarily concerned with the health of all Alaskans. We have previously provided you some written commentary, so I will be extremely brief. And I would just like to underline the fact that the Alaska State Medical Association strongly supports and urges you to support and expeditiously take action on SB 139. As mentioned in the written testimony, the effective pool of physicians out there that are available for recruitment from around the country is effectively reduced by a growing tendency towards a reduced number of hours that physicians have been spending on direct patient care. And in addition to that, I would like to highlight the fact that if the experience nationally follows what has occurred in Massachusetts when they adopted the their version of health system reform in 2006, the the noble purpose of including insurance coverage has precipitated a crisis in the numbers of physicians available to meet that increase in demand for care. So again, I will keep this brief. The Alaska State Medical Association supports SB 139. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. We'll now go to Don Pathman, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Don Pathman, and I'm a practicing family physician and professor of Department of Family Medicine at the Cecil Shepps Health Services Research Center at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and I'm calling in the early afternoon from Chapel Hill. For about 20 years, I've been studying the outcomes of loan repayment and incentive-type programs in the health professions, looking at the state's experiences and federal experiences. This work has been published in over 30 papers and peer-reviewed journals, and I believe and I hope that the committee members have received two of those papers that are most relevant in their packets, I suppose. I currently serve on the National Health Service Corps' National Advisory Council, and it's important to know that in 2008 and 2009, I worked with a very impressive and broad Alaskan work group that developed the original proposal that's contained in Senate Bill 139. In just my couple minutes of remarks, what I wanted to speak to most was simply to about the various types of support for service programs, and particularly the evidence of the relative effectiveness of the loan repayment and the direct incentive type, and reinforce that there are differences to be expected from how the different types of programs perform. Senator Olson has already spoken to the fact that programs like loan repayment and direct incentives are designed for people who have completed their training and they're ready to serve right then, whereas the scholarship or loan programs where there's a service option, which are other ways to design these incentives, one needs to wait years. In the case of physicians, typically 7 years or more before they're ready to serve. But the other issues are the programs differ in how many people who sign up will complete their obligations and then how long they stay in their practices. If people have before them that paper called Outcomes of State Scholarship, Loan Repayment, and Related Programs for Physicians in Medical Care, or later on if you want to look, on Figure 1, we present analysis of 69 different state programs like the one proposed here, and on the far right of that curve, shows the percentages of about 29 loan repayment and financial incentive programs, like talked about for Alaska Now, a proportion of the people sign up for these programs who actually complete their service, and you'll see that across the country the average is about 92%.
Dr. Pathman, can I get you to finish up, please?
Sure can. Whereas it's much lower in scholarship and loan service option. If you later on take a look at Figure 3, you will see that of the various program types, retention is also longest in loan repayment and incentive programs. And I'll stop there, sir.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony today.
Yes, sir.
Elizabeth Ripley, please.
Hi, this is Elizabeth Ripley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Matsu Health Foundation in Wasilla, Alaska. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today regarding SB 139. Just a little bit about the Matsu Health Foundation. We're a 501c3 that owns a part of the Matsu Regional Medical Center. We helped to build Matsu Regional in order to provide better access to acute care for the fastest growing community in the state. Our foundation helps to govern the hospital and ensure that it provides top quality care that meets the needs of our community. The mission of the foundation is to improve the health and wellness of Alaskans living in Matsu, and we have a goal to become the healthiest borough in the state by 2017. We have four strategies to reach this goal, and one of those is to reduce barriers to health care access. One barrier to access is the lack of health care professionals to deliver the health care services. On the acute care side, Matsu Regional spends thousands of dollars annually to recruit these professionals, most of them from out of state, especially for the hard-to-fill positions like pharmacists, physical therapists, and others for which there is no professional education within the state of Alaska. And until that needed technician is recruited, the hospital still has to deliver that quality care. That means it has to hire what we call travelers from out of state with the credentials to fill these needed slots in the interim. Metairie Regional has spent $6,238,000 on contract labor over the last 5 years on temporary health professionals from outside the state to fill current needs. And actually, this is probably one of the lowest expenditures for contract labor of hospitals in the state. Because we have a new hospital and a growing community, we've had great success in recruiting. So believe it or not, the $6 million is low by industry standards. Despite what Metairie Regional is doing, our foundation is still concerned that this workforce barrier is limiting the access Metairie residents have to primary care in particular, especially in our rural areas. Both community health centers in Metairie are understaffed and face constant recruitment challenges. And national studies, as Dr. Pathan pointed out, have determined that loan repayment and incentive programs to be two of the most effective strategies in terms of both recruitment and retention. I've included a resolution, you should have it in your packet, and there's quite a few more details about the workforce needs in Metairie, which I won't reiterate. But I do want to make one more point. I commend you for closely watching the state budget and looking critically at state spending. An investment in a loan repayment and incentive program is just that, an investment, and it has a phenomenal return. For instance, according to Jackson and Coker recruitment specialists, the total average compensation of a family practice physician is $237,186. If affiliated with the hospital, that physician generates a net revenue of $1,675,000. Now that's the national average, and that's when the doctor is affiliated with the hospital. But even family practice docs associated with a community health center or in private practice impact our economy favorably.
Could I get you to finish up, please?
Yes. Every doctor that moves to our state represents a new business, one that employs receptionists, nurses, bookkeepers, accountants, technicians. Every healthcare professional we recruit is an economic engine that will generate jobs and income to our state, an incredible ROI. And for that reason, the Metairie Health Foundation promotes and advocates for Senate Bill 139.
Okay, thank you. That concludes our off-net. We're now going to come into the room. Mr. Trivett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Is that better? In the interest of time, quite a few of the comments that I was prepared to make have already been dealt with by staff, so I'll keep this very, very short. Obviously, this bill is going to make it impossible for Alaska to attract.
We need to start by identifying
who
you are and who you represent.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, I'm Sam Trivett. I am the medical information director for the retired public employees of Alaska. I'm here speaking on my own behalf today. I've been working with seniors and retirees in the state for the last decade plus since I retired from the state of Alaska. This bill will make it possible for Alaska to attract new healthcare professionals. We are competing nationally for this talent. We want the incentives in this bill to attract young Alaskans to go into the healthcare fields and remain in or return to Alaska with their skills. Alaska has the fastest growing senior population in all 50 states. Retirees in this state contribute about $1.7 billion annually to the Alaska economy. The spending generates nearly 15,000 year-round jobs for residents from around Alaska. It's been extremely difficult to find a primary care practitioner in Fairbanks or in Anchorage to see a new Medicare patient. There were 25 physicians that were willing to see new Medicare people in Anchorage in 2009. That number is down to 4 as of earlier this month, down to 4. If seniors can't get medical care in Alaska, many will end up moving where the services are available outside Alaska. If we want to continue to have retirees remain in Alaska and spend their savings, their pensions, their health care dollars here, we need to have the medical professionals here to serve them. This is an extremely efficient bill. It's pretty darn cheap for, in terms of bang for the buck, and I would urge you to support this bill and pass it out. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Trivett. Just as a reminder, we've got four people signed up for public testimony, but that's going to pretty much take care of the calendar this morning because we're done at 10:30. So just for those waiting for other bills. I just want to remind you. Go on to Shelley Hughes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Shelley Hughes, Government Affairs Director with Alaska Primary Care Association. Back in August 2008, I convened the work group that began work on this group. It's a broad group of both private and other organizations that were concerned. We were all hearing the same message. We were hearing from our primary care members that they were, on a weekly basis, hearing from candidates that they were taking offers in other states. We were losing. We were behind the eight ball. We weren't competitive. We aren't today. In fact, the number of states now that, and a little update, two more states have added programs, so we're only one of three states without a program. The national shortage is very concerning. Only 2% of medical students are going into primary care, so we're going to be looking at a shortage of 125,000 physicians over the next 15 years. And in Alaska, the entire state is actually designated as a health professional shortage area, and we're seeing vacancy rates anywhere from 10 to 30%. That's very, very high. And what is happening is what we're seeing in the primary care clinics in the community health centers is a vicious cycle. We're seeing a turnover of every 3 years. And we're burning out the ones that are left with the load. In fact, Senator Olson tells a story about how he fell asleep delivering a baby in between a woman's contractions because of the lack of enough providers and the load the providers have to carry. I just want to say that one of the things as a work group when we worked on this is we wanted something that worked. We wanted something that was cost effective, and that's why we brought up Dr. Pathman. We wanted to know what was best for Alaska, and we customized it for this state. And every 100% of every penny spent will mean that a vacancy is filled. So we're not going to be chasing anyone down there, and we will get what we pay for. So with that, I just want to say this is a good complement to the Grow Our Own. It will help Alaskan students as well. And I urge you to pass this bill out of committee. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony today. We have a nurse in the house, Nancy Davis.
Here.
Because there's two Nancy Davises in the house.
Nurse Nancy. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Davis. I'm a registered nurse. I live and work as a nurse in Juneau. I'm here this morning as the president of the Alaska Nurses Association, which represents over 1,100 registered nurses in Alaska. I'm going to say ditto to all of the facts that have been presented and the encouragements about Senate Bill 139. I would only add that we do know that health occupations are growing in our state and in the country. This is going to continue for the near and the long term. I think that Senate Bill 139 is a wise investment in our recruitment and retention strategy. We say that Alaska is open for business and that we want to invest in that particular approach. I think that Alaska needs to be open for business to critical health professions because those are essential to being open for business for all the other industries that we try to attract. With that said, I would just say that the Alaska Nurses Association supports Senate Bill 139 to attract and support all health professionals that we need in Alaska, and we urge you to pass this bill. Thank you very much.
Marie Darlin.
My name is Marie Darlin, and I'm here representing AARP. And we just want to urge you to support this bill. There's no sense in repeating everything that you've just heard. We just want to remind you that if we cannot provide for the population coming up and all, that Alaska is certainly going to be the loser if we can't keep our seniors and other people in this state because we have the health care that they need. I guess that sums it up pretty much to say that we urge you to support this bill.
Okay, thank you. And quite frankly, that's a pretty efficient way to testify rather than repeat everything because we do pay attention. Now we'll go to Nancy Davis, the other Nancy Davis.
Okay, for the record, I'm Nancy O. Davis. I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Pharmacists Association, which is a nonprofit 501c6 professional association representing pharmacists and pharmacy technicians in the state. We support Senate Bill 139. With the passage of health care reform, it's anticipated that there's going to be a shortage of increased demand of 17% for pharmacists alone. We don't have a college of pharmacy in Alaska, so we can't compete with other states, and this will provide an opportunity to recruit pharmacists. Loan debt for pharmacists is about $150,000 because they incur out-of-state tuition. And it's a professional degree that takes 6 to 7 years now. It's a doctorate program. And this bill will allow healthcare providers to be recruited to out of underserved areas in the state.
Okay, thank you. That concludes our public testimony portion on this bill. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What we've heard right now is that we're losing the battle here in Alaska. We have more patients needing health care that are adding to the rolls every day than we have number of new health care providers. We're just not keeping up. That's why I feel this bill is so critical. And part of the reason has to do with the tremendous amount of debt that graduates are having when they come out of school. This has been forcing these professionals to the mega metropolitan areas where they can increase their salary to pay off these issues. Pay off these debts. And obviously, as was pointed out, the competition for these professionals is going up because other places are also feeling the pinch as well. So this allows us to get to be to have a program that has an incentive program and Alaska, as was pointed out, Alaska is only one of three states that doesn't have that. With that, Mr. Chairman, I ask your support for this program.
Okay. Any final comments or anything? We're going to go ahead and set this bill aside.
Mr. Chairman, just one quick comment.
Senator.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Very briefly, Mr. Chairman, as Senator Olson said, we don't want to lose any battles. Some of us feel strongly about that. Number two, I'd just like to thank Senator Olson for his leadership because this is critical, and I'm firmly behind you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
We'll go ahead and set this bill aside for further review. That concludes the session this morning. The other four bills on the agenda will be taken up tomorrow at 9 a.m. And as noted, we have bills previously heard posted, and we'll try to get our workload done by Friday afternoon so we don't have to have a Saturday meeting. This meeting is adjourned.